केवल है.
Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listen to Tenzin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and thanks for joining us on the program today, where we're going to continue with our examination of Shanti Davies' The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. We're on the fourth chapter, the chapter called Commitment, and it comes after Shantideva has already taken the Bodhisattva vow. Now, of course, some of you who have only recently joined the program will at this stage ask, what is the Bodhisattva vow? It's a commitment made by someone who wants to gain enlightenment, not only for their own sake, but to help all other beings free themselves from suffering as well. The vow, in the Tibetan tradition consisting of 18 major and 42 minor branches, basically covers one's behavior, particularly in regard to others. Once you have the vow, you're on the road to becoming a bodhisattva, a being whose focus is to help others in whatever way possible, but primarily by working to become a Buddha, because a Buddha has the greatest capacity to assist others. Your work, then, is to develop generosity, morality, patience, enthusiasm, concentration, and wisdom until they become perfected in your mind. Once that you have accomplished that, you'll be a Buddha with a sole aim to benefit all beings everywhere. Of course, taking the vow and working to become a Buddha is no small undertaking. And at the end of last week's program, Shanti Davis says, as he hadn't cleared his mind of all its afflictions, he must have been mad to undertake to clear others' minds of theirs. But instead of becoming fearful of what he'd done, the vow made him all the more determined. The two verses read, when I promise to liberate all those beings dwelling in the 10 directions as far as the ends of space from their disturbing conceptions, I myself was not yet freed from mine. Thus, unaware of even my own capacity, was it not somewhat crazy to have spoken like that? But as this is so, I must never withdraw from vanquishing my disturbing conceptions. Pema Chodron, whose book No Time to Lose is a commentary on this text, says that the difference between a mature bodhisattva and one still in training is that the first will see the impossibility of the task as a spur, whereas us lesser mortals might feel inadequate or despondent. She writes that the very craziness of taking the vow is an incentive for Shantideva, and I quote, to do whatever it takes to live his life as attentively and wakefully as possible. Instead of indulging in guilt and other variations on a theme of failure, he spurs himself on. And the next time we feel downhearted about our meager efforts, we can encourage ourselves with Shantideva's words, as this is so, I must never withdraw. Every courageous gesture we make, she writes, whether or not we think it successful, definitely imprints our mind in a positive way. The slightest willingness to interrupt our old habits predisposes us to greater bravery, greater strength, and greater empathy for others. No matter how trapped we feel, we can always be of benefit. How? By interrupting our defeatist storylines and working intelligently and wisely with our kleshas. By kleshas, she of course means the afflictive emotions. So those are the verses we got to last week. And now, before we carry on with the text, let's take a moment, as usual, to set a good positive motivation for the program today. The best motivation, as I always say, is bodhicitta, making our purpose to gain enlightenment not only for our own benefit, but to best benefit all beings everywhere. Therefore, please join me if you can to set this motivation for participating today. Thank you. Now, in South Africa, where I was born, there's an Afrikaans word, koptu, that literally means head closed. Someone who is koptu is absolutely and stubbornly resistant. Nothing will persuade such a person to change their mind. When I read Shanti Deva's next couple of verses, they reminded me quite strongly of the word koptu. The verses read, "And to do this will be my sole obsession. Holding a strong grudge, I shall meet them in battle. But disturbing conceptions such as these destroy disturbing conceptions, and for the time being are not to be abandoned. It would be better for me to be burned, to have my head cut off, and to be killed, rather than ever bowing down to those ever-present disturbing conceptions." Wow, that's pretty cop too, don't you think? If I'm honest, I must admit that I find the aggressive intent in these verses a little off-putting. Given that it takes a long, long time to free oneself from emotional torments, Shantideva is promising himself an interminable period of internal battle, and I wonder how someone without very powerful internal resources will be able to put up with it. It is ingenious that he intends to use anger to destroy emotions such as anger. Pema Chodron calls it a homeopathic approach. But somehow to me, Thich Nhat Hanh's approach of recognizing, acknowledging, and in a way befriending the emotion, then calming it before letting it go, makes easier sense. What were his words again? "You know fear springs from yourself, and that mindfulness also springs from yourself. They are both in you, not fighting, but one taking care of the other. Become one with a feeling. It's best not to say, 'Go away, fear, I don't like you, you're not me.' It's much more effective to say, 'Hello, fear, how are you today?' Then you can invite the two aspects of yourself, mindfulness and fear, to shake hands as friends and become one." This seems to me a very effective way to deal with emotional turmoil, because it seeks to preserve peace of mind, even as it minimizes the effects of the afflictive emotions. And Thich Nhat Hanh's gentle approach is perhaps even more courageous than stirring up anger to counteract anger. However, Pema Chodron sees Shantideva's battle cry as passionate enthusiasm that drives what she calls his all-consuming warriorship and joy, and says that over the years she's come to better understand his passion and determination. Strangely, though, in her writing, she's much closer to the serene magician Thich Nhat Hanh than the fierce warrior Shantideva. Well, I am open to the argument that the difference may be in expression rather than method, but what do you think? In any case, Shantideva now makes the case that when ordinary enemies once defeated are exiled from a country, they regroup and prepare to attack again. But when the disturbing conceptions are defeated, they will never be able to build the power to return. Common enemies, when expelled from one country, simply retire and settle down in another, Shantideva says. Though when their strength is recovered, they then return. But the way of this enemy, my disturbing conceptions, is not similar in this respect. Deluded disturbing conceptions, when forsaken by the eye of wisdom and dispelled from my mind, where will you go? Where will you dwell in order to be able to injure me again? But weak-minded, I've been reduced to making no effort." His Holiness the Dalai Lama comments that in some descriptions, the word deluded in this last verse is given as weak. Although the effect of the afflictions on our mind may be very strong, the afflictions in reality lack any power or even potential, His Holiness says. That is their real characteristic. Compare the afflictive emotion with its remedy, and you will see that their modes of perception are very different. The afflictions come from an incorrect grasp of reality, and because of that, have no actual power. The antidote, wisdom, arises out of the knowledge of reality as it is, so has a great power to counteract the afflictions and place us in peace. His Holiness points out that although we have both afflictions and wisdom on our minds, they cannot arise simultaneously. Therefore, the way to overcome the afflictions is to strengthen our wisdom to the point at which the afflictions become totally unable to manifest. The afflictions are like the snow lion in the annual snow lion dance at the Tibetan monasteries, and we are like the youngest monks. According to the Lama Dzigka Khontrul, the prancing, rearing snow lion was absolutely terrifying to the young monks. However, as they grew older, those monks came to realize that the creature was only actors in a costume, and they lost all terror for it. Similarly, when the eye of wisdom reveals the nature of reality as it is to us, the afflictions will lose all their apparent power over us, wither and die, precisely because we no longer are taken in by the great lie that sustains them. As Pema Chodron states it, their power evaporates once we see their empty, ephemeral nature. And here, Shantideva puts aside the warlike rhetoric to attack the afflictions from quite a different angle. If these disturbing conceptions do not exist within the objects, the sense organs, between the two or elsewhere, then where do they exist and how do they harm the world? They are like an illusion. Thus I should dispel the fear within my heart and strive resolutely for wisdom. For no real reason, why should I suffer so much in hell? Pema Chodron thinks that for all his battle imagery, this proves that Shantideva is not really urging us to take up arms against the afflictions. Rather, he encourages us to examine them closely, to see their real illusory nature. Next time you get angry, try to find where the anger is, she says. Is it in the person you're angry with? Is it in your sense perceptions? What is the nature of this anger, and who is it that is angry? And we can even look at the thoughts that feed the anger. Where do they come from? Where do they stay in the mind, and where do they go to? If we can give away the immediate story and focus like this, we can quickly see that there's nothing solid to hold on to at all. But if we give in to the story and allow the thoughts to take over our mind, they seem very real and very persuasive. And this is how we build fantasies in our mind, believe in them, act on them, and so allow the afflictive emotions to rule us, even though they are insubstantial. This enemy, says Pema Chodron, is a mirage. His Holiness the Dalai Lama points out that afflictive emotions like pride, anger, jealousy, and so on arise dependent on conditions and causes, like some external object of attachment or an immediately preceding mental state and so on. Taking, for example, seeing a form we have become attached to, like a person we're attracted to. His Holiness says that when the form of the person appears, a particular consciousness related to sight perceives the form. Then a conceptual thought arises. Ah, a form is there. The mind sees it as beautiful, or perhaps ugly, but as if it was intrinsically like that from its own nature. This is the grasping mind coming to play. We then reify the beauty or ugliness. Maybe the form is 10% beautiful, but we see it as 100% delightful and go after it. And there we have attachment. The same thing happens if we see someone as disagreeable or ugly. But instead of developing attachment, this time aversion takes over and we push the person away, act coldly, and so on. These are the mental processes in the arising of attachment or aversion. And as Pema Chodron also points out, His Holiness says we experience attachment and aversion as very solid, as existing quite independently. Yet if we analyze to see where they exist, as Shantideva suggests in verse 47, we have great difficulty in finding them. The afflictive emotion arises in dependence on many factors, like grasping at intrinsic reality, the object, the person in whom the affliction arises, and so on. But if we try to trace where this affliction resides, in the object, the person, etc., we cannot find it anywhere. What is this affliction then? It is nothing, says His Holiness, but it comes about through mere designation, mere nomination. That means it is merely a label on a basis of causes and conditions and does not exist solidly from its own nature. And when we can see it like that, the affliction settles down and decreases in intensity. His Holiness uses the example of the Chinese and Tibetans' fear of ghosts. When they see what they think is a ghost, they become very afraid. But if someone says, it's not a ghost, it's only a shadow, their minds become immediately calm. Because the ghost is not findable, the fear disappears. Then His Holiness turns the argument around and examines if there's a real person who's being harmed by the ghost. For the ghost to be a harm doer, His Holiness points out, there must be a person who is harmed. But if no such person exists, no harm doer can exist. In other words, the ghost is designated a harm doer on the basis of the person who is to be harmed. The harm doer does not exist concretely and independently apart from the victim. Similarly, the afflictive emotions and the mind grasping at intrinsic reality need a solid target. When we look for the solid and real person that the afflictive emotions harm, we come to realize that there's no solid target, no real independent self. And so the self-grasping mind is undermined and loses its intensity. His Holiness follows that argument with another, using the example of a person called Tashi, for whom we develop a strong aversion. Try to analyze where this aversion lies, says His Holiness. It is not part of Tashi. And if we look at ourselves and analyze closely, we can't actually find where this hatred is. It's a mere designation. Now let's explore His Holiness' example a little further. Let's say Tashi makes a comment I don't like. Then a feeling of aversion arises within me, and I say, I hate Tashi. Now, where is this hate? It does not cover Tashi. It is not in my head, nor my heart, nor my hands, nor my feet, nor my belly button. It's not sitting like an independent lump in my mind. Wherever I look, I cannot find hate as something that exists solidly and inherently from its own side. It is only a coming together of Tashi's comment, my perception, a reaction based on my conditioning, and so on, that I label my hatred. And if I sit and look at what is happening with bare attention and no story attached, it fades away, like the ghost it really is. But when I label it hate, believe in it, and thus give it power, it appears very real. It takes over my life and causes lots of harm to me and perhaps to Tashi. It also lays the foundation for much suffering again in the future. Then in the closing verse to this chapter, Shantideva says, therefore, having thought about this well, I should try to put these precepts into practice just as they've been explained. If the doctor's instructions are ignored, how will a patient in need of cure be healed by his medicines? Here again, Shantideva uses the analogy of the doctor and the patient. If the doctor prescribes a medicine, but the sick person doesn't pay any attention to the prescription, there's very little chance that the illness will be cured. Similarly, even though we may listen to the teachings and take the precepts, if we make no effort to apply what we've learned or to live by the precepts, no change will come about in our current samsaric situation. We will just carry on acting out our habitual patterns and be ruled by our afflictive emotions, and so we'll have no chance of freeing ourselves from cyclic existence. Enlightenment will be out of the question. In summarizing this chapter, His Holiness says that we should take from it the importance of our human rebirth and the faults of afflictive emotions. Once we have considered these well and have a good understanding, we will realize the need to practice conscientiously. His Holiness quotes one scholar, Manya Kunsu, who enumerated the many faults of afflictive emotions. They disturb our mental peace, he said, and harm us both in this life and in our future lives. Under the influence of afflictive emotions, we're also often quite willing to harm others. Also, when we have strong aversion or attachment, our minds become sluggish because we often can't sleep and even our food doesn't taste good. Even when we are with people we usually like, such as friends and relatives, we're irritable and difficult to get on with. Now, you can see that it's impossible to experience any real happiness or peace of mind when these emotions rule our lives. And of course, the more we give in to the afflictive emotions, the further and further away from nirvana we put ourselves. His Holiness also says the afflictions bring a great sense of fear and also result in bad reputation. For instance, if we are always irritable or angry, others will not want to associate with us and will talk badly about us. Even those with lots of patience will eventually have enough and draw away from us. I had a good example in one of my meditation classes that I lead during the week recently. We were meditating on anger, and during the discussion, one lady told me about a friend she's had for many years. This friend, she said, can be quite charming, but also has a terrible temper that lashes out at some of the slightest provocations. Every time this happened, the person in my class felt very uncomfortable, but she tried to develop some compassion for her friend. However, it all became too much, and eventually the person in my class had to tell her that if the temper tantrums continued, they could no longer be friends. The lady was very contrite, and for a while the tantrums subsided, but now they were just as strong as ever. The person in my class is in the process of now giving up the friendship entirely. We could say that someone like that, who is so overtaken by afflictive emotions, has problems that need to be addressed by counseling or therapy. But first, they have to take responsibility for their reactivity. This is what His Holiness and Shantideva are saying here. Unless we look at our afflictions in the face and admit to what is going on, we are unlikely to want to do anything about them, even though we can see how they destroy our friendships and peace of mind. But perhaps the worst of the afflictive emotions is that they bring us so much suffering in future lives. Whatever we are placing on our mind stream now will ripen into our experiences in the future. So if we habituate ourselves to anger or attachment or any of the other many afflictions, they will cause us many problems in the future. I sometimes wonder about the karmic fate of a man who was in the news in 2006 and who seemed an excellent example of the destructive power of afflictive emotion. His name was Edwin Tahara. He was a former Black Power gang member, and he died in someone's driveway when he was shot in the neck with a shotgun. Evidently, he was known for his violence and had been in and out of jail for assaults. You may remember him as the man who collected a petrol station attendant on the bonnet of his car after a dispute about paying for petrol and drove him into the glass window of the petrol station. The attendant, Glenn Bennett, luckily lived to tell the tale, but Tahara spent a year in jail for that offence. It didn't deter him, though, for some time later, some of his associates caught up with him and, after an altercation, shot and killed him. The newspaper article that reported on the death said that residents in the street where he lived said he was a tough man who many people feared. Now imagine habituating your mind all your life to violence like that and dying in such a violent manner. What could you expect in your coming life or lives? That affliction is surely going to haunt you and lead you into hellish experiences. As His Holiness says, if we give in to the afflictions, they will inevitably land us up in the lower realms after death. His Holiness goes on to say that while the faults of being distant from nirvana and going to the lower realms are particularly applicable to Buddhists, it is even important for non-believers to know the faults of the afflictions. In particular, the afflictions destroy people's peace of mind and mental calm as soon as they arise, and also tend to skew analysis. Our investigation of our internal world and of reality should be unbiased and objective, but the affliction, being biased, tends to obscure reality. For instance, during one of His Holiness's many discussions with scientists, a psychologist told him that when someone develops a dislike of another, they exaggerate the ugliness of the disliked person by 90%. And this accords exactly with what we've been saying in the Buddhist teachings. Thus, it is very important for even non-believers to understand the fault of afflictive emotions. And so we come to the end of Chapter 4 of Shantideva's text. Stephen Batchelor's translation of the title of Chapter 5 is Guiding Alertness, while Pema Chodron labels it Vigilance. In any case, it refers to always being aware of what the mind is doing and not allowing it to wander as it wants, to territories that it has no business being in. Pema Chodron also calls this chapter Taming the Mind, for, she says, if any outer discipline is to transform us and for our bodhicitta not to diminish, we have to tame the mind. As the first verse of the chapter reads, those who wish to guard their practice should very attentively guard their minds, for those who do not guard their minds will be unable to guard their practice. Now the method for guiding the mind, according to Pema Chodron, is shamatha meditation. That is, fixing your mind on an object, very often the breath is used, and bringing it gently back and again as it wanders off. I think you may all be familiar with this meditation, as it's widely practiced not only in Buddhism, but in most disciplines that employ meditation. The goal with this meditation is calm abiding, the ability to put the mind on any object and it will stay there for as long as you like without any discomfort. The Sanskrit word shamatha means calm abiding or developing peace, though this meditation is also known as a tranquility meditation in some schools. As Pema Chodron says, we use the meditation to come back again and again to the immediacy of our experience without harshness or judgment. When the mind is wild, we have no foundation for maintaining discipline, she writes. Specifically, the three disciplines of not causing harm, gathering virtue, and benefiting others. How can we work with the kleshas or act and speak with kindness or reach out to others if our mind is crazed? Without the stability and alertness of a tamed mind, how can we be present? Therefore, mindfully, gently, and repeatedly, we train in coming back. Taming the mind takes time. Through good and bad moods, through periods of peacefulness and klesha attacks, we train in being present. Day by day, month by month, year by year, we become better able to keep a rule of life, better able to hear the cries of the world and extend a hand. The beauty of the breath is that it's always there, so we can always bring our mind back by just concentrating on breathing. If we build a formal daily practice of sitting and focusing for a few minutes on the in and out breath, slowly over time, increasing the length of time we sit, we will eventually be able to bring the mind back easily and quickly. It's important to start with such short meditations and not to push beyond what the mind is comfortable with. And now time is up once again and we must go. Thank you for being with the program today, and please dedicate any positive potential from our discussion to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I hope we'll be together again next week. Till then, goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful. Beneficial. Empowering.